welcome to the Double Loop Podcast, your source for everything about fingerprints. While you're working on your comparisons, we'll talk about comparisons. I'm Eric Ray.
And I'm Glenn Langenberg.
Welcome, Glenn. Happy, well, day late, April Fool's Day.
Yes, and happy just after Easter.
That too. So let's jump right into things. First off, if there's anyone out there who's enjoying what we do and wants to send a couple bucks our way, you can go to patreon.com/doublelooppodcast to join a few dozen other contributors that we have on the show. And any help, even just a dollar here or there, is very much appreciated.
Indeed.
All right, Glenn, do we have a game here today?
We do. We have a quick where in the world that I prepared for you.
All right.
I think you'll get this one. I'm confident. Ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Kilts were actually first originated here and eventually made their way to Scotland. It has Gaelic origins, which is where the term Gaelic actually comes from this country.
Okay. Not Scotland. Got it.
Right. Next, it is illegal to throw out food in this country since 2016. If the food is edible, it must be donated.
Okay.
They're very much into cooking. Two new cookbooks come out each day.
Whoa.
Yeah. The country is referred to the hexagon based on its shape. They have the most Nobel Prize winners.
Sorry, is that like per capita or is that just sheer numbers?
Sheer numbers.
Okay.
Yes. They have most number of winners of the Nobel Prize.
Sure.
The camera phone was actually invented here. And finally, they consume more snails. In fact, 500 snails per year, drink more wine than anyone, and have more than 400 plus cheeses.
Well, this has got to be France.
It is France.
Okay. Interesting. I remember hearing a story about, speaking of like the shape of it, that some king, I can't remember which one, you know, ordered a grand survey of France. And after these mathematicians had gone out and very carefully surveyed everything, the square mileage had shrunk by a quarter or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then France had lost more land in that with that survey than they had in any war.
Yeah, I had France on the brain. Okay. Last week I was teaching in New York City. Actually, the class was in Queens, but had made my way into the city a couple of times in Manhattan. And then for the weekend, stayed over there through Easter weekend.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, I love New York City. For me, it really is one of the greatest cities on earth. I absolutely love it. I've been going there since the end of the 80s, early 90s, and wow. I've just always loved it. And this time was no different. Had a chance to meet with some friends, went to some very special places, went to this university club where they have it's members only, where they've got, walk-in humidor and serve top shelf scotch and get to go out on the patio and survey the city and Midtown and right in the shadow of the Empire State Building. So that was kind of fun. And one of the nights I went to see a Broadway show. And so I met up with a friend. We did a French dinner. So I kind of had France in my mind, hence the choice this time. And I had a very nice French meal, French wine, and then went and saw Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on Broadway.
Oh.
And it was incredible. It was really, really, really good. I don't know if you know much about it, but basically, I'm not much a fan of musicals, so there's no real musical singing or numbers in it. There's some little bit of dancing and movement to it, but it's basically more of a play, but it's a play with lots of magic to it. And there's lots of very...
Oh, that makes sense.
I mean, I was sitting there watching a lot of really cool things going, oh, I know how they do that, but that's a cool adaptation
for
that illusion or that trick. It was very cool. I mean, one of the coolest things in the show is one of the characters drinks polyjuice potion and turns into another character, from the books. But to do this in real time on the stage, the actor drinks potion, turns into his cloak, and then turns around. It's a completely different actor. And there's only one person on stage, and then this actor becomes another actor, which is really cool. And there are a couple of different little things where people were practically teleporting across the stage and moving about and lots of vanishing and all kinds of cool magic stuff. So it was really, really enjoyable for me.
Well, on a much smaller scale, a few weeks ago, went and saw a production that my youngest daughter was in for SpongeBob the Musical at her high school. And So she usually does like tech and sound, but in this production, one of the like kind of more up in the front kind of things was Foley. So she had a whole range of stuff to make noises with, which was fantastic. However, my favorite part of the show is I can't stop laughing about it. The guy that played Squidward in the show, they attached another set of like fake legs with another pair of pants behind his with shoes facing backwards. And he would just walk across the stage with these kind of fake legs moving with his real legs. And I laughed every single time he moved anywhere on stage. It was just the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
That's cute. That's great. I'd go see SpongeBob the Musical on Broadway.
And I've been traveling as well. I've spent the past 3 weeks in, let's see, St. Louis, Los Angeles, and Indianapolis. So all over. And another few weeks traveling after this one here at home. So good thing that we've got a few minutes here tonight to set aside for the podcast.
Yes, probably end up being a two-parter with a couple of guests, hopefully, and very excited to kind of talk about this case. Mm-hmm. But before we do, and we get into that case, I have a voicemail for us.
Oh, okay.
The listener left us a voicemail.
Long-time listener, first-time caller to the show. Just wondering if you realize that your theme song sounds a little bit like a knockoff Saved by the Bell theme. For any more constructive criticism, just reach out to me and let me know. Talk to you later. Bye.
Interesting. And who emailed us about the theme song?
Voicemail.
Who called in about the theme song?
That would be one of my friends from high school. That would be Dave Mextraw, a lay listener who's friends with Bo, who we did an episode with Bo's question the one time.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I think Dave was Dave had something to share with us, and I wanted to make sure that we gave him credit for that. Now, I did actually go and listen to the theme to Saved by the Bell because I don't know it very well or remember it. I think he's smoking wacky tobacco and may have dropped an edible.
I was going to say, I'm not hearing it really. I mean, well, so I guess we haven't really talked about our theme song. Or if we did, it was a very long time ago. We just have kind of kept using the same one for a very long time. But so this came from a band called Blue Wave Theory. And the specific name of the song that we use is called Jazz Hole. So, Glenn, you probably occasionally look at the file name when you do the editing, but I'm not sure if you always... I always have to look it up because it doesn't stick in the mind, you know, always, because I just go to that MP3 file. So Blue Wave Theory is an instrumental rock band from New Jersey, formed in the 07, and they do reggae, punk, jazz, and progressive rock. So... however long ago we started doing this, 10, 11 years ago, I sent an email out to them after finding their song on a website that was like, here's some bands that have put their songs open for podcasters or whoever to use for different things. So I sent them an email, say, hey, can I use this for our podcast? I said, sure. So it became our theme song. But yeah, I don't quite hear Saved by the Bell. There's not that bell, you know, that starts the Saved by the Bell song.
I don't know it that well. That's why I had to listen to the two side by side.
Not quite.
Just wanted to share an opinion from a listener.
I guess you're a couple years older, man. I remember where every day you could watch Saved by the Bell for like 4 straight hours. If you turned to the right channels, it was just on constantly.
Oh, my God.
But
well, for Elizabeth Berkley, at least Showgirls era, I am familiar with her in that role.
Oh boy, I worked at the movie theater that year. That was well, one other thing before we start the actual topic for this week, I'm going to be starting a research project here very soon, and I'm looking for participants. So the research is on using the frequency of ridges to set the resolution of an image, right? So, you know, the studies have been out there for 100 years now as to what the average ridge frequency is, but what I'm looking to do is measure an examiner's ability to be accurate in finding the right kind of perpendicular line to ridges to count out and set the resolution. So if you're interested in participating in this study, please send me an email, eric@rayforensics.com, and I'll get you all the information that you need from there. I need people who already know how to do this in either Photoshop or in APHIS software. So yeah, the study isn't going to be teaching people how to do this. I need people who already know how and seeing how accurate they are.
Got it. Well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else before we get started?
No.
All right, let's jump in.
Okay, so the case I wanted to discuss with you, Eric, and kind of get into some details, which I've already started sharing a little bit, and our guest will be related to tonight, is a case out of South Dakota called the Jeremiah Peacemaker case. Peacemaker, yes, like the John Cena character from DC on HBO, Peacemaker. Okay. But no relation to the show. So this is a case of a young woman by the name of Kendra Owen that was living in Watertown, South Dakota. She was murdered in September 2020, and it was rather gruesome crime scene. She had been killed in her apartment, and she had been there for some period of time. Now, that's actually one of the sticking points, is exactly when she was killed, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later, given that there was significant decomposition. Also, at the scene, she was stabbed violently 16 times, and then she also had her head severed, which it's not exactly clear when that part happened as well. There are some things that indicate to me that it probably was not done while she was still alive, given some of the blood stains at the scene and some other things. There might have been some extended period of time where the killer maybe even stayed there for some time and desecrated the body. And there's a lot of little unknowns here, so I'm just kind of trying to lay this out. The critical evidence and how I get involved is I get a call in, I think it was 2020. I get a call from the defense attorney for Peacemaker, and there is a bloody or alleged bloody fingerprint involved in the case. And Peacemaker, his thumbprint is found potentially in blood on a tube of toothpaste in the bathroom adjacent to where her body is in her apartment. And Peacemaker had no real connection to her other than he had met her at a bar. That was the understanding. Again, some of these little details I'm going to talk about, I need to get fleshed out more when we hopefully have some of the attorneys on the show and some other folks involved in this case come on and talk about it.
Sure.
But at this point, I just know about this fingerprint. I do a comparison to the fingerprint, ultimately end up identifying Peacemaker, I believe his right thumb, which is the conclusion that the local examiner, I should say local, at least for the state of South Dakota, the local examiner worked for the state lab in Pierre, South Dakota, but had received the evidence, had also identified Peacemaker. And an interesting little part of this was not an APHIS hit. Peacemaker had become a suspect in a very interesting way, which is also one of the contentious points in the case, that the cops had a suspicion that he was in the area, but there wasn't any really good reason to think that he did. We'll get more about that probably from the attorneys, but very strange way that he gets involved. This is not like other cases. There are a lot of things about this case that are very bizarre to me and unusual. But it's not an APHIS search. He's named suspect in the case, and a local examiner identifies him. That's how I get involved. And I also look at it, agree that it's his thumbprint. And I was trying to explain to the attorney, because the attorney's like, are you sure? Because we just don't think that he did this. I mean, there's this timeline. It doesn't fit the timeline. Are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? And I was like, well, I'll get this verified. But look, in the scheme of things, fairly straightforward print, even though it appears to be in a blood-like substance, and that by itself can make it a little complex. There's a ton of features here. It's like the entire thumb. I should also mention that it had been processed with Amido Black as well. So it had been enhanced without the Amido. There's a photograph of it that shows very faint-looking ridge detail, but when the Amido goes on it, it looks beautiful, and it's a really, really, it's the entire right thumbprint.
I would assume it's obvious that from the photographs, the before and after processing, it's very clear it's the same print. And
yes, except there isn't an evidential photograph before. There's like a scene photograph before that shows the ridge detail. And there's enough of it where you can go, well, it kind of looks like it's probably the same. And then when you compare it, because there's writing on the toothpaste tube, you can compare the writing to where it looks. So you can tie things all together.
Sure. Okay.
But there was not an evidential photograph before, at least that I ever saw.
Still, good practice of taking the pictures before and after, especially on blood prints.
But it really was a scene photograph, or at least that's all I received. And again, maybe there was more, but that's all I actually received.
Okay.
So, you know, I was trying to explain to the attorney on the scale of things, this is pretty overwhelming. There's, you know, 40 some matching features, et cetera. And he's still a bit dubious. And he's like, are you sure? You know, is there any chance? Like, this would be the greatest close non-match in recorded history. I'm telling you, it's his print. As sure as I can be about anything, it's his print.
Right.
But I got it verified, did a really good blind verification as well, really kind of tested it, gave the print and multiple people to the verifier. Verifier came back, obviously, to the same identification. And then I did something I'd never really done before. I asked her, what if I was to tell you that the potential donor of this print is on camera the entire time during when this event happened and physically could not have been present to lead this at the scene? Would you still have the same opinion? And she, without hesitation, went, absolutely. You must have left it in another time.
Sure.
Because there's no way that's not his print. I mean, if it's not his print, we must question everything we know about fingerprints.
Right. Yeah, it's somewhat rare that you get up past 40.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, so I end up issuing a report that basically says identification as well. And then I get a lot of questions in the following. Now, this is November 2020, and this case goes on for years. And every couple of months, I get a call or an email from the defense attorney for Peacemaker. His name is Scott. I get contact from Scott all the time. Well, what about the blood? Can you tell if it was made in blood or with blood? Can you tell if it is blood? And how would you tell if it is blood? And what can you say? And what should a fingerprint examiner say about blood and so forth? And my report was very careful to call it a blood-like substance. I think at some point the report says, you know, I'm going to assume it has the qualities of blood, but I don't know that it's been confirmed to be blood. And that was one of the very first questions when I saw the image that I asked Scott was, has this been confirmed to be blood? Have they done any kind of confirmatory test on it? And at that time, the answer was no. All they had done was a presumptive test, although it wasn't clear what presumptive test they had done at that point, but presumptive test. And then later they had done DNA. And it turns out the presumptive test was phenolphthalein. So for any lay listeners, phenolphthalein is a presumptive test that you swab a suspected stain, blood stain. You get a little bit of suspected blood on a Q-tip. Then you apply a series of chemicals. And if it is blood, it will turn purple or pink almost immediately. Now, there are a number of other things that can give a false positive reaction and act like blood. And people that know this chemical have to be careful not to assume that it is blood, but it's a good indicator that it's possibly blood, right? And if you get a negative, then it probably isn't blood. And that's often how it's used. And if you get a positive, and that will tell the person, which in this case, the fingerprint examiner, this could possibly be blood. And so therefore, you should now apply these blood-enhancing dye stains to improve the quality of the fingerprint, which is exactly what the fingerprint examiner did and kind of followed her basic procedures.
With the phenolphthalein test, you also have to make sure it changes right away because it'll eventually oxidize and have the color change eventually anyway, right?
Correct. So this was another thing that came up at trial was whether the color change was immediate or not. That's often the phrase immediate. And I think of immediate within seconds, right?
Well, yeah.
I mean, if you wait minutes, and if you wait a minute, it will start to oxidize on its own. And just the air alone will begin to force a color change. And there was this discussion during trial about 30 seconds, and I think 30 seconds would be way too long to be waiting because you might start to get a weak reaction at 30 seconds.
Just from the air.
Right. And who knows what other contaminants could be on the surface that you're swabbing that could facilitate this. Basically, it's a redox, reduction oxidation reaction. That's what you're looking for. And if hemoglobin is present, it will help facilitate that. But other things can also facilitate that as well. So yeah, in 30 seconds to me, having done this test thousands of times, that was way too long. If it doesn't change, the longest I would probably wait would be 15 seconds. And if it's not changing within 15 seconds, I'm not going to call it positive. But this was testimony by a biologist that was there, and we're going to have a guest on fairly soon who's going to come on and kind of talk about some of the biology. So I just kind of wanted to set things up from the fingerprint perspective, because I actually start learning more about this case when I actually go to trial. Now, leading up to all of this, I actually don't think I'm going to be called to trial, because what am I going to be able to offer? I'm going to end up agreeing that's his print.
Right.
But turns out they wanted me to talk about whether or not you could say it was in or made with blood, which in this case, what I had said was there are certain indicators that you can sometimes find in one case or the other if it was made in blood or with blood. The distinction being with blood is on your finger. You have a bloody finger and you touch a surface and transfer a bloody print from your finger to the clean surface. That's made with blood.
Sure.
This is the scenario if you stab someone 16 times and get blood all over your hands and then go into the bathroom and start touching things in the bathroom, you transfer this wet blood to the surface, right? Made in blood is that there's already wet blood on the toothpaste tube, and you touch the toothpaste tube and press into that blood and leave a print behind. Believe it or not, especially our lay listeners, it's actually exceptionally difficult to tell the difference between those unless you've got certain indicators. In this case, there were a couple of those indicators that tended to show that the print in question on the toothpaste tube was more likely that there was blood on the finger, in my opinion, than the other way around.
There's a third option, though, right? Where the print is already on the surface and the blood hits it afterwards.
So that is a third thing, right? That's called a faux blood print. We had that a few episodes back. That was definitively not this case.
Okay.
Like, that was definitely not what was going on here. This was definitely, it had the substrate of all the indicators of blood visually, as well as the pheno test, the amino reaction. Although at this point, I mean, I still wouldn't call it blood until we have some kind of confirmatory test. So my report says something along the lines that there's more support for the observations under a proposition that it was made with blood than in blood. However, big caveat, there's no reason, because there's a big blood stain in the middle of the toothpaste tube, the finger couldn't push into that, and if as long as it's still wet, and then slide over a couple of centimeters and then leave an impression just right next to that blood stain. So the origin of the blood could have been the toothpaste tube. You could have touched that with a clean finger while moving it, and then the finger slides, and then you leave a bloody impression just next to that, call it deposit of blood, on the toothpaste tube. Or there could have been blood on the finger already and touched the clean tube and then just slid and moved around, touched a couple of different places while handling the tube. So really, I'm not saying anything very helpful here in the sense that I can't narrow down either of these scenarios. There could have been blood on the toothpaste tube, or it could have been blood on his finger. It's his print. If we accept that it's blood, which, again, depending on what tests were done, that's where things were. So ultimately, when I arrive in South Dakota, I arrive just in time for the fingerprint examiner's testimony. She's about to go on the stand, and I arrive and I see the DNA expert for the defense there. And basically, when I arrive, there's discussion about, oh, you're just in time. I had driven over from Minneapolis. And when I arrived, she was just about to go on, so I was able to hear her testimony. And then we were allowed to sit, me and the defense expert were allowed to sit and listen to the state's witnesses, and they were allowed to listen to ours if they wanted to.
Okay.
But it was very, very helpful to actually sit through other witnesses, because I never get a chance to do that. And one of the first witnesses I got a chance to see the end of was the medical examiner that was hired by the defense, which was, again, an interesting thing, because there were these discussions about when she actually died, And one of the things they pointed out was, you know, they could have done some forensic entomology that would have been helpful to pin things down a little bit, which was never done. And then there was also some discussion about what actually killed her. You know, was she alive when the head was cut off, and a number of other things here. So there is interesting discussion between those, but again, just kind of poking holes at some of the little facts. I also got to hear a little bit about evidence that was collected at the crime scene, which for a case like this, I was very surprised. And there was maybe at most 20 items that were collected from this scene, you know, a whodunit homicide. Yeah, that was my reaction too, was now they brought a lot of it back to the lab, and these examiners don't go from their lab to the crime scenes like we did in Minnesota. But I understand it's a, you know, smaller population state. They don't maybe have the resources to do that.
Sure.
But you really are entrusting your local law enforcement to make a lot of decisions about what to collect at the scene. And there might be some limitations in their ability to process in a small rural town like, you know, in South Dakota. And so, I was very surprised.
I'm assuming that the lab is in Pierre.
Yes.
Where was the crime scene again?
Watertown, South Dakota, which is basically on the eastern border-ish of South Dakota.
Close. Right. Got it.
Right. It's about an hour just west of Minnesota-ish.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes.
Maybe this leads into the testimony you're about to talk about, but did the word blood appear in the report from the latent print examiner?
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to say, because she got on the stand and she talked about the identification. She didn't demonstrate it, which I thought was surprising. I mean, if I was in her position, I would have wanted to have definitely shown the jurors and kind of walked through.
Sure.
But I was getting this kind of sense from the prosecutor that he had a really interesting attitude throughout this. And when I say attitude, like a little bit of attitude like, this is a slam dunk. I mean, what more do I need? I got DNA that's going to, you know, incriminate him. I've got a bloody fingerprint at the scene. We've got this, we got that. This slam dunk case. So it kind of seemed to be moving fairly quickly through some things that surprised me a little bit. But, you know, I'm not judging his strategy. It was just his seemed to be the approach. So she basically just kind of said, yes, I applied ACB. Here's my conclusion. There's an identification of the right thumb. Boom, bam. He never asked her about activity level, made in or with blood, which, fine, good. I don't know that she had that in her report anyway. But then she's cross-examined by defense, and I hadn't even really talked to them about this, but they jump on her pretty quickly and go, you know, read from your report and what this says here, and she reads a sentence that basically says, the fingerprint LP1 was comprised of blood. And so they ask her, well, how could you know that? And she said, well, you know, this is just our reporting language. Well, let's go over what, at the time, what was done. And she describes how the DNA biologist came down, looked at it. Together, they were looking at the evidence and decided where to swab on the toothpaste tube to test some blood with pheno. Then, once they got a positive, then the DNA biologist collected another sample for DNA, notably not in the apparent bloody fingerprint, but next to it, adjacent in an area. Now, there's a little bit of dispute exactly where she tested. What the fingerprint examiner said made a lot of sense. She showed where the ridge detail was and basically said right next to this. But it turns out about 6 months before this, there was a hearing where the DNA biologist had pointed to a different area on the tube because DNA biologist didn't actually document where she lifted her swabs from the tube. She basically went off her memory and didn't really describe it very well during that hearing. So we'll come back to that in a little bit. So now, the only thing that the fingerprint examiner knew at the time that she was writing this report was that there was a positive pheno test. So it had the visual appearance of blood, and there was a positive pheno, but her report says comprised of blood. So when defense kind of calls her out on it, here's the thing I want to give credit to, because I just sat there. I was amazed. Basically, defense says, don't you think that that was an overstatement of the evidence, or do you really think you should have expressed it that way or used that language? Her response was, no, you're right. I regret writing it that way now. And in retrospect, you're absolutely right.
Wow.
That was my reaction, Eric, was, wow, good for her. Good for her on the stand to go, yeah, you're right. That's a fair point. I was just using I think she referred to it as canned language, the language that our lab uses, but in retrospect, yeah, I shouldn't have reported it that way. It's only one sentence in her report.
Sure.
But it was a very good point the defense made, and I was so respectful of the fingerprint examiner to back off and go, yeah, yeah, you're right. The good point.
Well, so
and later that evening, I'm jumping ahead. Defense was like, I didn't really know where to go with that, and I could. By admitting that, I just kind of moved on and like, wow, I think it caught them off guard. I think everyone really respected it, and in my view, it really increased her credibility. And she never really got hit much more after that, and very little could be said. And eventually, when I did my testimony, I even was asked about it. And I said, yeah, I agree with what she said, including the part where she regretted stating it that way. Based on the test and information she had at the time, she should not have said it that way. And that's would it not have been appropriate to report that way, but she admitted that. And I wanted to give her full credit for being such a professional on the stand.
I mean, that's what you're supposed to do, right? Is be independent, impartial, and if something like that happens, yeah, remain impartial and say, yeah, so absolutely. But I'm going to look a little side tangent. I'm curious, back at your old agency, what did you used to write?
Apparent blood.
Apparent blood? We also had canned language at my lab. The word blood never showed up. It was every single time a reddish brown substance.
Yep.
Or something
RBS.
To that effect.
And it, yeah, exactly.
The word blood never appeared in our report or our notes because we didn't want to get into this exact situation.
Mm-hmm. It's why I thought we should do an episode on it, because at our agency, we did argue for reddish brown substance. And we were told, I don't want to call anyone out, but it was an old supervisor goes, you know, we're the Minnesota State Lab. Don't you think we know what we're talking about when we say blood? And like, and I said, yeah, but you know, this is the language that you'll find in the academic and in writings and in other. Like, well, I was respectfully told, Glenn, you're not a biologist. Why don't you just kind of stay out of this? And do you want to put that in your report? But we're going with apparent blood. And I was okay with that. It used to be blood.
Right.
It was when I first started there, they called it blood.
Sure.
Eventually, they went to apparent blood. And that's perfect timing for our guest tonight, who I think will be able to talk about the DNA biologist in this case, who was the exact opposite of the fingerprint exam. The fingerprint examiner backed off, admitted, and was very professional, whereas the DNA biologist doubled down on everything on the stand. And it was the craziest testimony that I had heard, but I'm beginning to realize that this is actually fairly common and is happening all over in biology. So I thought it'd be nice to have the biologist that was hired by the defense attorney in this case. And so we're going to welcome a guest, and I believe she's on right now. So Anjali Ranadev, hello.
Hello.
Hi. This case, it was nice to actually work with you on a case together and see you. You and I have known each other for some time. We first met on the Human Factors Committee for latent print examination some years ago.
Yes, we did.
Would you like to tell the audience a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got into forensics? And just share your history in forensics with us.
Sure. So my name is Anjali, and I am a forensic DNA expert at this point. I began my career working in a private crime laboratory that only did DNA. So unlike the Minnesota State Lab or the South Dakota State Lab or any of the larger state facilities that process all different types of forensic evidence, we only did DNA and some serology back then. This is in the early 1990s. So I worked as a forensic DNA analyst after getting a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in forensic science, and had the opportunity, because we were a private lab, to work on cases all over the country, which also included traveling all over the country to support those cases in court with testimony for the ones that did go to trial. After about 8 years in the lab, my mentor left the lab and went to start the forensics division of the National Institute of Justice in Washington, D.C., which is a subdivision of the U.S. Department of Justice. And she basically recruited me to come work for her. So I went and worked there by day and went back to school and went to law school at night And in 2002, when I completed law school, I left the DOJ and hung out a shingle and have been in private practice ever since, mostly doing the types of things that Glenn and I now do, which is consulting on individual cases that involve forensic evidence. I also teach. I teach a course on testimony and ethics at Arizona State University here in Phoenix, and I have co-written a book on ethics and forensic science with a medical examiner colleague of mine about 10 years ago now. I'm very passionate about ethics within the community, and one of the linchpins of that is what we say and what we do, and all labs have standard operating procedures, so we have to be a stickler to doing what we say that we do and making sure that we are truly there to assist the court and not mislead the court. And I think it was interesting for me to be involved in this case. It was especially interesting to be able to do this with you, Glenn, because when we both sat in the galley while the state's experts were testifying, we had the opportunity to just consult with one another, because I think both of our mouths were just on the floor for half the time. But just incredulous. Like, did we really just hear what we heard? And had we not had one another there to confirm that we weren't dreaming, I think we might have thought it was just a bad dream.
Yeah. And there are these moments where, because I'm not a biologist, I was like, I don't think that. And I was looking at you to see, am I right that that sounds a lot? And I would look at your face and go, oh, yeah, okay. So, yes, that should never have been said, what I just heard.
Right.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your observations, some of the things that stood out. Why don't you describe the testimony of the state's witness and some of the problems with that testimony?
Sure. So I think, as you mentioned, we had held a couple of different Daubert hearings in 2023 in preparation for trial, based mostly on serology and DNA issues. The crucial piece of evidence in this case, as I'm sure you've already talked about, was this fingerprint that, in your report, you stated that it was consistent with the defendant. But the wording of both the latent print examiner and the DNA examiner, all over the DNA reports, everything said blood, 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 blood. And we had a Daubert hearing in 2023 to try to have any use of a definitive statement that these stains were blood excluded, because there was no scientific data to back up those statements. In their reports, and again, there's been mention of, you know, canned wording, all labs have standard operating procedures. They have standard statements. You know, if the result is A, this is the sentence. If the result is B, this is the sentence. But I think there's been a lot of interest in the last many years on trying to revise some of those standard statements, because they just are not scientifically valid. And this case really brought a lot of that to light. They did what they admitted was a presumptive test, phenolphthalein test, which you've already referred to, and that was positive. And at both the hearing last year and at trial, the DNA analyst admitted that phenolphthalein was a presumptive test, and that presumptive does not mean that a substance is conclusively what is being tested for, that there are other substances that create a false positive, and that it is not definitive. It is merely, you know, a sort of an indication that you should look at that area or that stain further. And they also went so far as to, in their reports, merely state that blood was identified by chemical methods. And the analyst was pressed by defense counsel, asked many times why she didn't say the specific test that was done. She conceded that there were numerous presumptive tests. And when asked, why don't you put the specific test that you did so that the reader would know what was done? She tried to dodge the question. And Glenn, let me know if I'm getting this right, but my memory, she said at one point, we don't put the specific test in the report because we don't think that whomever is reading it would understand what phenolphthalein is or even be able to say the word.
That's exactly what she said. And basically, when the defense attorney said yes, but then when we emailed you and said, could you please tell us what this chemical test was, her response was, it was a chemical test.
Right.
So they basically called her out on the stand for saying, why are you hiding the ball? That was the phrase that they kept saying was, why are you guys hiding the ball on this? And she's like, we're not hiding the ball. Then why wouldn't you tell us? Well, we did. No, you wouldn't tell us which test or the limitations of those tests. We had to do that ourselves. And do you really think a police officer reading this report is going to go through all the effort to contact the lab, figure out what the test is, what the limitations are? Or do you think they're going to read this report and just then assume this must be blood based on this test? And she would not concede any of that and basically said, well, I was just following my procedures. We're just following our procedures.
Right. Well, she did say, you're right. She said, if anybody reading the report had questions, they're always free to contact me. But you get a letter from your insurance company and at least there's a phone number on the letter and it says, if you have questions, call me. It doesn't say that anywhere in the report. How is one to know that she would be gracious and, helpful were you to call?
And it sounds like she wasn't. Even when you did, they wouldn't say.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, it was like, what Apple did you have? The Apple. Like, she was answering the question with the question. It was dumbfounding.
So a few weeks ago, probably it was right after the trial wrapped up, I get an email from Glenn with a transcript of the evidentiary hearing. And I'm just reading through this going, it seems like the answer to every question, I mean, actually, I think you're giving her more credit than is due, wasn't even this is the answer, but it was, well, I would have waited 30 seconds and I would have.
Yes, that's how she testified. Like, and I kept saying when they asked, and then what did you do? Well, I would have transferred a part of the swab to a tube. I would have added, I'm literally sitting in my chair going, did you do that? Or should you have done that? Or would you, like, I've never heard that.
That's exactly my thought. It was like, whoa, who testifies like that? That's you can't do that.
Right.
The even more incredulous part was getting to the end of that and seeing that the judge still kept it all in. I'm like,
yeah,
judge with testimony of saying I would have and not what actually happened.
Right.
I was confident that it was the judge was going to go a different direction.
As were we. And yet she did not. One other thing I do want to just make mention of too, Glenn, to further the craziness of the testimony was, in addition to absolutely refusing to explain why they wouldn't just show their hand and say the name of the test, she also kind of tried to hide behind their accreditation.
Yes.
She many times answers to many questions were, well, we're an accredited lab. And basically she was inferring, if not actually saying, we're an accredited lab and we do things this way and we haven't lost our accreditation, so we're fine.
Yes. No, she definitely said that. That was actually one of the points I was going to bring up was exactly this. Because I have seen, not just in this case, I've seen this with many times when someone gets called out on a bad practice, they immediately go, well, we're accredited and I'm just following our SOPs.
Right.
And then what she said, that the implication, and I've heard in other cases, is, if an assessor had a problem with this, they would have said something to
right.
us.
And they would have made us change it, but they didn't.
They made us change it. And that is such BS. And whenever I hear examiners say that on the stand, or when the listeners even had that in their repertoire, please disavow yourself of that, because likely at some point you and or I or someone will have to contact this laboratory and the assessment body, because the way that she was pinning all this on the assessors, basically saying, they have signed off on our practices and they don't have a problem with how I'm testifying. I'm sorry you do, but we would lose our accreditation if they had a problem with that, which is complete BS. Because what she was testifying to was not in the report. What was in the report were the results of the test, which again, we had some issues with. But then even what she was saying on the stand is not in any report anywhere.
Right.
And they would have no way of knowing that she's testifying in that manner. So, Anjali, do you remember this part of it? Do you remember her basically saying, I can scientifically conclude, based on these things, that this is the victim's blood?
Yeah, she basically, first of all, we need to go back for 1 second. They'd done the phenolphthalein test. After we had the hearing, which the defense lost, the judge basically said, after hearing our testimony and the state's testimony in the Daubert hearing, the judge said, I've heard enough. I think there's enough to show that state has done enough testing to be able to testify that these substances are blood. I'm going to allow it and you can basically hash it out at trial. So we showed our hand, and in between the Daubert hearing and the trial, the prosecutor went back to the lab and said, you need to do some more testing. We need to be better prepared for trial. And so I'm paraphrasing, I wasn't there, but I'm assuming. So they did another test. And that test also came back positive. This was a test called the Hematrace test. And she insisted at trial when asked about this test that the Hematrace test is a confirmatory test for blood. My testimony disagreed with that. And again, it was up to the jury to decide, you know, who they believed. But we had peer-reviewed scientific published articles that were actually only about less than a year old, which is astonishing because usually when you come into court with something, it's, you know, 10, 20, 30 years old. But this was a fairly new article that had, and the article was a survey of presumptive tests for body fluids. And Hematrace was right there with phenylphthalein and a couple other presumptive tests for the detection of blood. There were numerous other body fluids that were found to have false positives, some in fairly alarmingly high rates.
So, Anjali, why don't you talk a little bit about this Hematrace test? And you said it's got some false positives, et cetera. How does Hematrace work? How is it different from phenylphthalein? And why would some people consider it, and as we heard in this case, more of a confirmatory test? What are the distinctions between the two?
Presumptive test is usually a simple chemical test where you add, in the case of phenylphthalein, you add two different chemicals to a stain. And if the substance that you are seeking to identify is present, you get a visible color change. The problem with the presumptive tests is that they are not specific to that substance, like whether it's blood or saliva or semen. And there are lots of other things that are not even body fluids or not even human in origin that could also produce that colorimetric change or seemingly positive result that are not the thing that is being targeted. So presumptive tests are used in a crime lab to help steer an analyst or an investigator possibly on a crime scene where to look further for potentially probative evidence. A confirmatory test would then be the next logical step that would be taken if it is critical that the identification of the source of the stain be known. In many, many cases, we don't care where it came from. We don't care if DNA came from blood or saliva or skin cells. We just are trying to identify whose DNA it is. And so those serological tests are never even performed. In this case, it was of utmost importance to the state's case to prove definitively that this substance in which the defendant's fingerprint was made was blood, and that it was human blood, and that it was the victim's blood. A confirmatory test is a test that looks at something specific to that substance, and when you get a positive result, it is considered to be definitive and would enable the examiner to conclusively state that the substance being sought is in fact that substance. In the case of blood, as we've mentioned, there are three or four different presumptive tests that exist that can suggest or indicate the presence of blood, but no more conclusive statement than that should ever be written or testified to based purely on a presumptive test. Hematrace is a newer test, and if you do a literature search, there are some websites or articles where you will find it being discussed as a confirmatory test. It functions actually very similarly to the home COVID tests that unfortunately we're probably all too familiar with. It's a, what we call an antigen-antibody test. So there are antibodies in the kit that you buy in the Hematrace kit. And then if the antigen that is present in the hemoglobin of human blood is present, they would combine when you conduct the test and you would get a positive reaction, much like the COVID test. You get a little line. If the test is positive, you get no line if the test is negative. And some do consider that to be a confirmatory test. The problem in this case is that there is a fairly decent amount of literature and professional publications, peer-reviewed publications and research that suggests that, in fact, it is not as conclusive as advertised. And in controlled research studies, there were other body fluids that were found to give positive results that were not blood. And some of them in fairly higher rates than you would expect than it to just be sort of happenstance. So when you have a test that yields fairly high false positive results, it is misleading and, in my opinion, unethical to emphatically state that those tests are conclusive and definitive. The analyst in this case went one step even further when the defense attorney was pressing her as to why she didn't specify which chemical test she did and how she could be so certain that the substance was blood. She said that she was basing her opinion on the cumulative effect of four different tests that she ran, and that the combination of those four tests told her, with her experience, it was in fact blood. And when pressed about what were those four tests, one was visual, which means she looked at it. I'm not certain who has scientific x-ray vision that you can look at something and be able to definitively know what it is, but that was one of the four that she claimed contributed to her opinion. The second was phenylphthalein, which she admitted was only presumptive. The third was hematrace, which she testified that, in her opinion, hematrace was confirmatory. And then the fourth was that she ran a DNA analysis. And the fact she testified that the fact that she obtained human DNA when she ran the DNA test confirmed that it was blood, which is just utter nonsense.
Yeah, your answer to that was so good. I don't know if you remember exactly how you put it. I do. You were very clear that just because you have a DNA profile, we should not assume that it is coming effectively from blood. Even if blood is present, we don't know the cellular source of this material. We don't know where this is actually coming from. You can get a DNA profile from lots of different fluids. And then you also made the point that the DNA is not in the red blood cells. It's in the white blood cells. So even if you are detecting hemoglobin from red blood cells, that does not mean that's the source of the DNA. And you kept making an analogy, apples and oranges. These are two very different tests. One is a test for the presence of blood. One is a test for the presence of DNA cellular material that can then be turned into a DNA profile. And I thought that was a really clear distinction.
So let me go run through those four. So there's, you know, something that's a reddish brown stain. And there's, so kind of breaking things down for any of our lay listeners out there. Lots of things can look like blood, especially after they dry.
Rust.
Right.
Right. Rust. Now, you know, on a toothpaste container, I wouldn't bet on rust, but
If you had seen this bathroom, it could have been dried feces. I mean, the bathroom had not been cleaned in a year. I'm making a presumption, but it was filthy. Okay.
Fair enough. The phenylphthalein test, I mean, lots of things can react with phenylphthalein. Not necessarily blood.
Right.
For hematrace with the antigen antibody, so I used to work at the blood bank a long time ago. This is a much newer technology, but antigen is just a thing with a three-dimensional shape. And correct me if I'm wrong, because this is 20 some odd years ago that I did this. And an antibody is something your body makes, or we can make artificially, that binds in a three-dimensional shape-like thing with antigen. So they're just, you can think of like an antibody is like the top of a Lego brick, and an antibody is the bottom of a Lego brick.
Exactly.
But at this scale, things are very complex shapes. So there's all sorts of different antibodies. It's just two things that can fit together. And then when they fit together, this test, you know, produces a color change. You can actually see it. But there other things can have a similar shape, similar enough to create the reaction. So it's not surprising to me. Like I said, 20 some odd years ago, we got all sorts of false positives on the antigens for hepatitis and HIV and all the stuff that I was testing for.
Right.
And then DNA, obviously everyone knows lots of things have DNA, skin cells have DNA, saliva, feces, so none of these don't add up to a confirmatory test.
I have to say something about the hematrace test, because that wasn't done until later,
to us having the hearing, they decided to go back and do it. Correct.
And one of the things that she said in her testimony that really caught me off guard was that all she needs to conclude it's blood in a normal case is the visual the phenol test and the DNA. So the helotrace is actually something special about this case they wouldn't normally do, but she said that's all I need to scientifically conclude. I'm allowed to scientifically conclude that it is blood based on the visual phenolphthalein test and the DNA result. And that's all she needed. And I remember going, wow, okay.
Yeah,
the hemotrace was exceptional in this case. And I had one more thing about the hemotrace. So if they collect these antibodies the way I think that they collect these antibodies, and based on my understanding of how the test works, which I've done a little bit of reading now since this trial, I think the forensic fields are getting a little hung up on confirmatory versus presumptive. Mm-hmm. I get the idea of presumptive. What I would have done and the way I would have approached it is to ask the question, isn't the hemotrace test more specific for the presence of blood? And that's about the best you can do, the presence of blood. And that's where I think the confirmatory for it is blood is a real problem. Because if you test a stain and the idea that you can tell what that stain is, as opposed to being able to detect the presence of blood within a stain. And I think that got lost because it could be a mixture of semen with a little bit of blood in it.
And some of the stains were at least two person mixtures. So even if there was blood, going one step further, you still could not definitively say it was the victim's blood. It could have been the defendant's blood and the victim's saliva, or the defendant's blood and the victim's sweat. I mean, so again, she was just overstating and overreaching and absolute refusal to concede an inch.
Yes, correct. And then falling back on accreditation, if they had a problem with this, we would lose her accreditation, which again is false because they would not know she's testifying this way in the courtroom, taking the results of these tests and then combining them all, like you said, the totality of her observations to say, and that was the phrase, I can scientifically conclude that that is the victim's blood.
Right. And then my favorite part was then, Glenn, you'll like this, when the prosecutor said, and is that opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability, which is a phrase that I believe Marty Jackley, the attorney general of the state of South Dakota, made up, because I've never heard it. Glenn's never heard it. He came at me with that phrase. He came at Glenn with that phrase. And we just did not. We were just speechless.
Say that phrase. Say it again.
Is your opinion, are you stating that opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific probability?
Probability. That was the phrase. I think he meant to use the scientific certainty phrase.
I don't think he did, because he said it 4,000 times. I mean, the first time he said it, Glenn and I literally looked at each other and said, have you ever heard? Nope. No. Okay. I'm not crazy. We've never heard it. Every single time, either the state latent examiner or the DNA examiner said anything along the lines of an opinion, he made sure that they stated that it was to a reasonable degree of scientific probability.
I bet you anything he'd heard the reasonable degree of scientific certainty for 50 years or some odd, and which doesn't mean anything either, but he was just trying to find another way to go down that path when it was clear that it wasn't a certain conclusion, right?
He was trying to get everybody, right? He was trying to get them and us to quantify our opinions, and both Glenn and I refused to do so. Whereas, again, this case, I believe, with the exception of the latent examiner who did concede that she would have, you know, that she changed her answer to her credit, I believe that this is an example of coached testimony. I think, as Glenn said, he was completely arrogant in thinking that they had a slam dunk, which after the verdict, he did a complete 180 and said, you know, we didn't have all the evidence we would have liked, but we thought we would give it a try anyway.
So, spoiler alert, we never got to the verdict, which is great. Much to my surprise, now maybe not you so much, Anjali, but much to my surprise, a couple days later, I hear from the defense attorney that he was acquitted on all charges. I think he had been charged with first degree, second degree, maybe kidnapping?
It was three different murder charges. I think they gave the jury the choice of either first degree, second degree, or manslaughter, and they acquitted on all counts.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. Manslaughter, third. Yeah, acquitted on all accounts. And I have to say, I was really surprised.
I was too.
I don't know what your reaction was. Oh, okay.
Now, right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, we basically testified in very similar fashion to the testimony that we presented, at least related to the DNA and serology evidence from the hearing last year, which we lost. And I had the sense that at the hearing, the judge really wasn't understanding the nuances of confirmatory, presumptive, wasn't appreciating that you really can't, you know, multiply those four tests together like the product rule, you know, and have a firmer, you know, resolve. And at trial, although it was the jury that rendered the verdict and not the judge, I did get the sense that she seemed to understand the science a little better just in the way she was making her rulings on objections on both sides.
I got that too. You and I didn't talk about that. I had that same feeling that she could begin to now see the cracks in the case and the testimony that was happening to jurors. I almost got the sense, oh yeah, this is actually misleading. Based on what I know now,
right.
This is really misleading testimony to allow her to keep saying it that way.
Right. So she was upholding objections and overruling objections that not completely in favor of the defense, but in a more fair manner, I felt, than than her rulings at the hearing. And so I think in a criminal case, the prosecution has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. I lived in South Dakota for 8 years. I really was skeptical after the hearing, the way it went, and just not certain that the jurors would pay attention or get it. And I don't know about you, Glenn, but when I was on the stand, when I was actually testifying, I felt that they were engaged. They were listening. They were attentive. Yeah. And even just subtle differences in things that I think you just learn. I mean, you and I both have 30 years, right, of experience, and both of the state analysts had less than 10. And for whatever that's worth, it doesn't mean we're better than them, but I think we just, things come more naturally to us from experience. Like when they testified, I felt like they were really hanging on the prosecutor's words, the state experts. They were watching him and responding to him. And you and I both respected whomever was questioning us and listened to the questions. But then when we testified, we talked to the jury. We weren't talking to the attorneys. We weren't talking to the judge. We were talking to the jury because that's what we've been, that's just, we don't know any other way to be. And there were jurors asleep during the state expert's testimony. And they were definitely engaged. When I was testifying, I couldn't see them as well when you were testifying. But did you have that same experience?
Yeah, I did, because I saw their reactions and smiles, especially when there was a little back and forth with the prosecutor. There was a couple of moments where he started doing a couple little tricks, and I got it.
Yeah.
There's one moment he got under my skin, and I got a little snippy and just kind of shot right back to the jurors. You know, whatever. It was basically said, you know, something like, yeah, but you would never report that it is blood based on that test, as we heard earlier in that testimony, something like that. But I don't feel that he treated me the same way he treated you. You guys definitely got into it a few times, and he definitely seemed a little more dismissive, I think, of your opinions and your approach.
Yeah.
I don't know that I got that as much from him. At least I didn't feel that way when I was up there. One of the other things we didn't talk about was that there was a sweatshirt. When he became a suspect, they then went to his apartment or wherever he lived, and they wanted to do a search, and he basically showed them clothes he was wearing the night that he had met her in the bar, and was very helpful during the investigation, like showed them stuff.
Yeah.
And then my recollection is they collected a dark-colored sweatshirt that he was wearing earlier when he met her in the evening in that bar, and that was their connection, which we didn't talk about in this episode. We'll talk about in the next one. That he meets her, hangs out with her at a bar for a little bit. He walks her home, and he's effectively the last person known to have seen her alive. His story is he goes in, he spends some time with her, they listen to some music, he uses the bathroom, and then he leaves. And then I think he goes back to the bar or something. That part I'm not real clear about, but he was wearing a sweatshirt when they were at the bar. They were in close contact, and they're... analyst said that she found victim's blood, a stain of victim's blood on the sweatshirt, on the arm of the sweatshirt.
Right.
And that was, I think, another thing that was disputed was, well, again, are you sure it's blood? Could it have been her saliva or skin cells? If it was blood, could it have come from, I guess she had scabies, and so she had some active bleeding wounds, could have been something like that that simply transferred to there. So that was, I think, the other little bit of tie-in. And then maybe a blood stain on his shoe, I think.
Nothing on the shoe, just the sweatshirt. And again, the only tests they did for blood were the same panel of presumptive tests. So to definitively call it blood was misleading. He admitted to being in her home. It was August, summertime. She was found, I think, with a tank top on. So as you stated, she had this documented medical condition where she had like open sores on her body. And there were bloody Band-Aids and tissues in her home, some of which were collected for evidence. But if in fact it was her blood, there certainly were alternative explanations for how those trace amounts of blood could have gotten on his sweatshirt. And as you mentioned, he voluntarily gave it to law enforcement. He wasn't trying to hide anything.
Yeah. And we're hopeful to get, you know, maybe Scott to come on the next episode and talk about some of the facts of the case. Some other things that I have questions about that I don't really know a lot about. And maybe even the prosecutor, if he'd be willing to come on and again discuss. But I really don't know. Did the cross-examination do such a good job of the evidence that they just kind of dismissed it out of hand altogether and basically say, well, there's all these other reasonable explanations for this? Because, Eric, in the bathroom, there were bloody bandages in the bathroom. And so one of the things was, could he have moved the bloody bandages, got some blood on his finger that way, and then touched the toothpaste tube? I mean, there was a lot of potential other sources of blood even at the scene when she was alive.
Right.
So I really don't know.
I know. I wish that there had been an opportunity to question the jury, but my understanding, you and I were both already back home by the time the verdict came in. My understanding was they went to deliberations in the afternoon and actually came back that same night about 10 p.m. with the verdict, which nobody expected. Yeah, they were in deliberations for about 10 hours. I don't know why they didn't stop for the evening and reconvene, but whatever. So everyone, you know, the defendant and the attorneys and everyone had to come back to the courthouse for the reading of the verdict. And at that point, because I asked Scott after the fact, you know, did anybody talk to them? And he said it was so late and everyone was so tired. You know, that was like the last thing on our mind. And I said, you know, is there an opportunity to do that now? And he said, it is very strongly frowned upon to contact jurors after a trial is over. So I don't think we'll ever know. But I mean, to your point, Glenn, you know, all we need from the defense, right, is reasonable doubt. And so whether it was the totality of all of our testimony or whether there was just enough holes poked in the prosecution's theory of the case that they, you know, they might have still thought he could have done it. But, you know, they are instructed that unless you find that the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt, you may not convict.
And I don't know that they ever showed motive like that.
They didn't.
Like there's really no motive and certainly no murder weapon. Her phone was missing as well. And there were a couple of other things that just didn't really seem to tie together that. And again, the timeline, we'll again probably ask Scott about this, but I guess they put on some witnesses that saw her some days later, potentially.
Somebody claimed that they saw her like 3 days after she had supposedly already been killed.
Oh, wow.
And then as far as motive goes, I don't know if you heard this. In his closing, the prosecutor said, and again, if I had been there, my mouth would have been on the floor. He walked her home. He thought he was going to get laid. She wouldn't have sex with him. So he killed her. To my knowledge, there was absolutely no foundation laid throughout any testimony prior to that statement coming out of his mouth to suggest that that was ever anything. I mean, he just was shooting it, you know, just coming up with it. And after the verdict, he admitted he was interviewed that they didn't have a motive. They never found the murder weapon. And they basically thought, and he even said this, we thought the bloody fingerprint, you know, the defendant's print in the victim's blood would have been enough. So even after everything, he's still perpetuating that language and using it. And some of the write-ups, even in the local paper, if you read them, you know, the reporters use that language, you know, testimony today about the fingerprint found in the victim's blood. I mean, so anyone reading it, there's no qualification. There's no statement of presumption. I mean, it is definitively being written that it's his fingerprint in her blood. And nobody's going to call the lab and say, can you explain this to me? I mean, they're going to take it on face value. And that's the danger of this kind of report language and testimony language that is just doing a disservice to the court, which is the opposite of what we as forensic scientists are supposed to do.
Yeah, we'll put links to the articles as well, along with this episode. I've got them saved. So as long as they're still on that local newspaper, people can go and check out, because they do it day by day. It's a small town. So they were there writing, I mean, a few thousand words a day, and like really capturing the testimony. You get a good sense of what was said during the trial reading each day in the newspaper.
Look, let me ask you guys a couple questions here, just to kind of covering a few things we talked about before. So first, when the prosecutor asked you guys about that reasonable degree of scientific probability, or even if you've ever been asked about reasonable degree of scientific certainty before, how did you guys respond?
This was not my proudest moment. This is when I got a little snarky. I started off not snarky, and then I became snarky. But I said, the first thing I said was, I don't think I can answer that question. And he said, why not? And I said, I honestly do not understand what it means. And what I should have said was, can you explain it to me? Because I'm fairly certain he could not. But I didn't, because he came at me. This is when he got snarky. We had already gone through my credentials. And in addition to being a DNA analyst, I am also an attorney. So he got very snippy and he said, you're an attorney and you don't understand what reasonable degree of scientific probability means. So I took a breath and then I couldn't help it. And I said, I am an attorney. I'm also a forensic scientist. And in my 30 years of practice, you are the first attorney I've ever heard use that phrase. I don't know what it means. And he just completely changed, like he just changed his, you know, whole demeanor and just dropped it and went on a completely different line of question. Yeah.
What about if you're ever asked about scientific certainty? So how do you respond to that question?
I'll let Glenn answer that, only because that's how he responded with that phrase instead. He was much more eloquent than I was.
When I got asked it, well, the first thing I said when he said something about, and would you say that that opinion is a reasonable degree of scientific probability? And I just kind of sighed and went, I was afraid you're going to ask me that question.
It was beautiful.
And I turned to the jurors and said, I know you heard a lot of testimony earlier, and many witnesses were asked that question and they responded. However, I agree with Ms. Ranadive, who testified earlier, that this is a phrase that forensic scientists are actually instructed not to use. So this phrase, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty or probability, however you're phrasing it, It's all the same thing. It's a legal term that lawyers learn in law school, and they believe that they have to ask that question in order to basically say that this opinion is reliable. And I think I then said, you know, he interrupted and said, well, you know, where's that? I said, Rule 702, that basically you're trying to establish foundation for it. I saw the judge nod out of the corner of my eye, and I took it as I can keep going. And I just kind of turned back to them and said, yeah, this phrase doesn't exist in any of the literature. You'll never find it in a journal article. Scientists don't use this phrase. It's really more of a legal term. And then he came back and said, well, what should I use instead? And I said, well, you're asking me about my opinion. Just ask me what my opinion is. And he said, well, okay, is that your opinion? I said, yeah, that's my opinion. And it's based on my training experience and the data that were available that I examined in this case and the methodology that I followed that are standard practice in our field. And he went, okay. And that was that. And we all moved on. But yeah, it was this moment of, oh, you're not going to ask me that question too. Yeah. And he did. But, and then the only thing he did later that I feel was a real misstep on his part, after I feel like the jurors seemed to have a nice rapport with them, he kind of tried to dig at me a little bit later. And after I said, look, I can't answer that question, I can't use that term, I was so clear about it. He then came back later and said, and would you say that's to a reasonable degree of scientific probability? And before I could even say anything, you know, there was an objection. And the judge just kind of looked at him. And I don't remember what she said, but she basically kind of said, the witness has already expressed that he's not going to use that phrase. And just kind of like chewed him out a little bit. And I don't think he gained any points with the jurors with that. It was a weird little dig. I don't know why he did that. Do you remember that part?
I mean, I can't get in his head, nor would I want to, but my belief is that it's an example of, you know, he prepped and these were the questions he was going to ask and he didn't know enough to rephrase it. I mean, that's why, like, I wish that I had asked him, I don't understand what that means. Can you explain it to me? Because I don't believe he would have been able to explain what it meant. And your answer was exactly what I would have said, you know, and the one thing I did say was, you know, you want us to qualify our answers. And sometimes science can't be qualified. We can tell you that the data supports A, B, or C hypothesis. Any of those three could legitimately have happened and are supported by the data. I can't quantify for you what percentage likelihood, you know, each one has or which is more likely, or, you know, like I can only tell you that the data supports any of these alternatives, and the fact that we can't definitively say that one is more probable than another should be enough to suggest reasonable doubt.
So then my next question is, you know, we talked about a few different presumptive tests for blood. What would be considered a confirmatory test for human blood?
Yeah.
The only one I'm aware of is called the Takayama crystal test. And it is, you know, I can't find anything in the literature to suggest that it is not confirmatory. I haven't seen anything to show, no research that's shown false positives with anything other than human blood. It's not something that's widely done, but it, you know, if you're in a situation where it is critical to your hypothesis that something is definitively blood, that is the only test I'm aware of that can be performed to support that kind of a statement.
Yeah, Eric, it's a microcrystal test. So yeah. you need a larger amount of blood to be able to, you know, dilute it basically. And then you add these like crystal forming chemicals to it, and it will form these very specific crystals under a microscope. So you need a compound microscope to see the crystal formation. But, and Anjali, I would even assume this, though, isn't it the same problem? You're still detecting some amount of blood. So if you had like blood in someone's urine, like let's say a 50-50 mixture of bloody urine, wouldn't it be the same thing? You're detecting the presence of blood as opposed to identifying the stain and the fluids in the stain, which I just don't know how you do that. That's why I think this whole confirmatory for this thing is going to always be a problem in serology.
It will. And that's why, I mean, I think, you know, he asked both of us, well, I don't know if he asked you, but he asked several times, do you have any issue with the actual testing that the lab performed? And I kept saying, no, I had no issue with the tests that they did, with the results that they got. My issue, and I think your issue, was with the language. It's the overstating and misleading and misrepresenting. Yes, there was a reddish brown stain. Yes, it tested presumptively positive for blood. Yes, you can say, I mean, we both gave them numerous alternative ways to say it indicates blood, suggestive of blood, but just saying blood and then insisting that anybody who's not sure can just call us up and we'll explain that, well, no, it's not really blood for sure. It's maybe sort of blood, but you know, that's BS.
Yeah, that's the part I'm struggling with, is I have to figure out how much did her testimony hurt her credibility, and then any conclusion she said after that, when it was still unnecessary. It was the prosecutor's job to make that inference for her. Here are the results of the test indicating it could be blood. And from that point on, he can call it blood, or he can infer it's probably blood or whatever. He's to get them to infer that. That's their job to infer it. But to get her to scientifically conclude it to a reasonable degree of scientific probability, oh my gosh.
I would not be surprised if he honestly believed that the testing, as explained to him by them, supported a conclusion to be able to say it was blood. I don't think he understands the nuances as well as even when we presented our testimony at that point, maybe started to doubt how certain it was, or he was just at all costs was just going to forge ahead and, you know, just keep insisting. They'd already put it out there. So, you know, he had, what did he have to lose to just keep trying to impress the jury with the fact that, you know, they did these four tests and that's enough.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know. I'd love to know more about the jury decision, of course, but
yeah, as would I. But I mean, yeah, I think that I honestly believe I do a lot of post-conviction work, and I honestly believed that in this case, if they had convicted him, it could have ended up being a post-conviction relief case. I mean, I can't tell you whether or not the defendant committed this crime. You know, we don't know ground truth, but if he had been convicted based on this evidence, it would have been a miscarriage of justice, in my opinion.
Yeah, having the assumption he was going to be convicted, I assumed we'd be able to get the transcripts from this and that exactly these things would come up later. And in fact, you are going to do a little bit of postmortem on this, right? You're looking at trying to present this at a conference?
Yes, I have submitted actually an abstract with Scott to the Promega meeting, which is the biggest forensic DNA organization. So I just submitted it. I, you know, we'll wait and see if it gets accepted. And then I'm planning to submit to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences for their February 2025 meeting. And I'm on the Arizona State Forensic Science Advisory Commission, and we have a speaker series. And so I'm going to pitch it to the commission to, I was going to pitch it to bring Scott in and maybe you, Glenn, to do a talk, but they actually want to try to develop a full day training for Arizona crime lab law enforcement bar and bench. So we may be bringing you in for that if you're willing to participate, if we can get something going.
Sure. Always. I really actually do enjoy teaching lawyers about this stuff and, you know, trying to, well, like in this case, it's trying to get accurate testimony that's reflective of the limitations of the test. Yeah. And I think that was the hardest part, was just getting her to admit the limitations of the test and then what she could conclude. It was bizarre. Well, Anjali, really, thank you for your time tonight coming on, talking about the biology and this. Again, I was kind of telling Eric and we were joking. It was refreshing that if this case got screwed up, it was from the DNA analyst and not the fingerprint analyst.
No, I mean, she wowed me. I mean, power to her for being a professional. You know, that's not easy, but it's the right thing to do.
And I know her, she had gone through one of the really cool training academies that we had done. So I remember when she was just kind of starting out. And yeah, it was really nice to see that. Yeah, she made me proud that day.
Yeah,
she was in allegiance and supportive of the science.
Yep.
And I thought that was great.
I was just going to say, do you remember when the defense attorney, she gave me an opportunity on redirect after all of this talk about accreditation. And she just said, you know, there's been a lot of talk about accreditation. Is there anything you'd like to tell the jury? And I just was like, are you for real right now? I get to do this. And I literally just turned to the jury and just taught. And I basically, because I had the opportunity, I just said to them, you know, you've heard a lot of testimony about accreditation and how the state is allowed to do certain things because it doesn't threaten their accreditation, but accreditation is number one, voluntary, and is merely a minimum set of standards of performance. The fact that you meet a minimum set of standards does not mean that you are performing at a level where you should be. And when people's lives are at stake in a criminal case, we as forensic scientists have an obligation to be neutral and not overstate or mislead the court. And I don't believe that the state is behaving that way, and we need to do better.
Yeah, you said it really well, and you basically kind of warned them, don't let this accreditation thing fool you. What you heard today was overstating, misstating, and I think you made really clear arguments. It's coming from the literature. It's coming from just my knowledge of the science. Yes, just because she has chosen to testify that way, that does not mean that that is acceptable.
Right. But the larger issue, right, in not just in this trial and all the trials where we aren't there, is if there's not someone there to question it, it gets taken as gospel. And that's an issue. And that needs to be fixed on a systemic level.
Yeah, if any listeners are interested, I would encourage you to look up Tiffany Roy, that's R-O-Y, on LinkedIn. She consistently posts DNA transcripts and DNA testimony, on a daily basis.
Yep.
Sometimes it's a little like, I can. And then other times it's like this case where it's just so out of bounds. And you just go, how is this the gold standard in forensic science? How is this happening? Why is latent prints and firearms getting beat up when this is going on?
Yeah.
And it's so incredibly bad. So if you want some good examples in other cases, look up Tiffany Roy's profile on LinkedIn.
I'm actually speaking with her. I spoke to her today, and we are looking into possibly collaborating and trying to get a grant to create some testimony training reform. So it's infantile stages right now. But I mean, I've been following her for a while. And after this case, she's the first person you contacted and said, you will not believe this one. So we want to see if we can do something to, you know, have some positive, you know, positivity come out of this.
That's great. Good job.
Cool. Anjali, both of you guys, thank you so much for sharing all the details of this case. It's been really interesting. And Glenn, I think like you, I don't really ever get a chance to see DNA testimony. So this was kind of a eye-opening in that regard, and I really enjoyed all this.
Well, thank you for having me on, gentlemen. It was my pleasure.
Well, thank you. And again, great job, and thanks for sharing your experience with us.
Sure. If anyone wants to get in touch with me, You can reach me at siloforensics@aol.com. That's how old I am. And it's been my pleasure being involved in the podcast.
All right, Glenn, so what do you have coming up here later this year?
Well, I have a class in the Los Angeles area. It's the Advanced ACE-V class, and that will be August 19th through the 23rd. If you're interested, go to ronsmithandassociates.com and sign up there. I will also be teaching in England in July. If you're English or in that part of the world, just email me, glenn@eliteforensicservices.com, and I can point you in the right directions. And it looks like I will also be in Switzerland teaching in September. So again, if you're a European listener and want to know more about that, email me. And always look for webinars that are available online. That's at evolveforensics.com.
And for me, I'll be at a number of different conferences over the next few months. So if you're going to be at the Texas Division or the Pacific Northwest Division conferences in June, the IAI in August, and still working out the details, but likely the North Carolina and Florida conferences later on in the year. See if you can go to those, and I'll be there, and you can see some presentation from me at each one of those. So if you want to get in touch with us, if you have any questions about this case, or if you just want to reach out on other topics, you can send us some emails, eric@rayforensics.com or glenn@eliteforensicservices.com. You can go to our webpage, doubleloop podcast.com, for all of our episodes, links to our merchandise store, all that kind of stuff, and also our Patreon page, like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. Remember, the opinions expressed on the show are those of the speaker, not necessarily anyone that we work for. And with that, I'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me on the podcast, and it's been a blast.